Hello, I'm Marilyn May. I'm the chair of the Alaska Bar Association's Bar Historians Committee, and we miss Leroy Barker, but we're trying to soldier on without him. Before we begin, I wanted to give you just a very brief synopsis of what the Bar Historians Committee is up to. The committee exists to preserve the history of the Alaska Bar and the Bench and Bar, really, both the bar and the judiciary. We have an archive, a joint archive, that is kept by and owned by both the bar and the court system, so we put all the historical materials together in one archive. It is available. We're working on making it more accessible, but if anybody has a historical project, we do have materials. They're at the courthouse, and it's accessed through the law library, so if you're interested in that kind of thing, you can come see what we have. We currently are working on a very exciting project that is with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Oral History Program, and primarily we're working with Karen Brewster, who's with that program. We are creating a judge's jukebox, and you can go online and see an example of a jukebox. It's not a judge's one. They have several, but one of them is on the mental health trust and issues relating to that. It's a place where you can access oral histories, either video or audio interviews, and listen to the interviews, as well as see transcripts. They also connect photographs and other maps, documents, other things. So it's a really exciting project. We've selected six histories that we already have, and we're going to be taking six more to add to create this jukebox, and then we hope to add to it in the future. So by this time next year, I hope I'll be able to give you the address, and it'll be ready to roll out. And then the other thing is that, in connection with that, we got a grant from the Alaska State Library to purchase some equipment, and we got training from Karen Brewster. Several of us from the Bar Historians Committee and others were trained in taking oral histories. Throughout the year, the committee is working on getting histories of members of the bar and members of the bench, and if you have any interest in helping with that, you can either join the committee or at least talk with one of the committee members about seeing that your pet project might be able to take place. And why don't all the members of the committee stand up so the other folks can see who they might want to talk to about these projects. Members of the Bar Historians Committee, please stand. Okay, thank you. All right, now for today's program, which is going to be very interesting. First, I will introduce Michael Carey. You've got the whole little biographies that they provided in their program, so I won't go over the whole thing, but just briefly mention, as I'm sure you all know, Michael Carey is a longtime journalist in Alaska. He's born and raised in Fairbanks and has a long history of interest in history, and so he's been presenting little historical programs for us through the Bar Historians Committee regularly, and if you haven't been to any of those, you should come because they've always been really interesting. He'll pick a case or a person or something that was going on in Alaska's past, and he really brings it to life. He's also the host of the Alaska Public Broadcasting show, both on radio and TV, called The Tradition. The next to him is Jack Roderick, who's a historical figure in his own right, former mayor of the Greater Anchorage Borough, and he likes to point out the father of Libby Roderick. And then on the end is Judge H. Russell Collins, senior judge for the U.S. District Court for the District of Alaska, appointed in 1984. So. Obviously have a long history with the bench, and I'm looking forward to hearing about its history with fixed names. Thank you all.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. A couple things. Is the recording going properly in the back? Okay. Can you hear me with the microphone, or should I just bellow? Doesn't sound too tinny. Okay. I would like to start by emphasizing a man, a place, and a time. A man, a place, and a time. The man is Ted Stevens, who was born in Indianapolis in 1923. He had a difficult childhood. He moved around among members of his family For a number of years, lived with his grandfather at several points, and then was sent to live with an aunt and uncle in Southern California, which suited him very well and played to his strengths. He started out in college, but then went into military service, the United States Army Air Corps, and came back, attended UCLA, Harvard Law, and briefly practiced law in Washington with the well-known attorney at that time, Northcote Ely. A place is Fairbanks, a mining camp transformed into a military town by World War II. There were two large military bases within 26 miles of Fairbanks. At the time Ted Stevens arrived in 1953, Fairbanks was both looking backward and looking forward, looking backward to the mining community it had been, and looking forward to become a modern town that would become a leader in a modern state. There were perhaps 8,000 people living in the city of Fairbanks in the mid-50s, with another 20 to 25,000 in the surrounding area, but there were so many changes in the community, and they were so rapid, it's really hard to get an accurate estimate of population. Plus, the military, for security reasons, never revealed the exact populations of Eielson Air Force Base and Ladd Field, which were changing frequently. The time Ted Stevens arrived was early 1953. This would have been, if not the height of the Korean War, a significant part of the Korean War, which had a huge impact on Fairbanks. There was lots of work, lots of people seeking jobs, lots of military presence, and a lot of crime. Not because the military is, or construction workers have a predilection for crime, but because what we had was large populations of mostly young men far from home and single men or men away from their families. Ted went into practice with Collins and Clasby when he arrived in early 1953. E.B. Collins had read law in Chico, California. He was approximately 80 years old at that time, and really not practicing much law, although his name was on the firm's door. Collins had played many roles in the community. He had been mayor of Fairbanks, a member of the legislature, and other roles in the community since it had been created in 1904. Charles Clasby was a 1933 graduate of the University of Washington, so he had, for that period of time, a modern legal education. By August of 1953, within 6 months after arriving in Fairbanks, Theodore Fulton Stevens was the United States Attorney for Fairbanks and the 4th Judicial District. This is really incredible to think that somebody of his youth and relative inexperience was chosen the U.S. Attorney. How did this happen? He was new to town. He had no criminal experience that I'm aware of. And I'm not quite sure if he'd ever been a lead attorney in a case until he arrived in Fairbanks. So why Ted? Well, it's important to realize this was U.S. Attorney then, as now is a political appointment. Dwight Eisenhower had been elected in the November election of 1952. It was the Republicans' turn to choose for the important political positions here in Alaska and other places. For one thing, they replaced Ernest Greening, who was the governor, with Mike Stepovich. Most of the local lawyers, and this is pretty hard to believe, but I checked the yellow pages. In 1953, only 15 private attorneys listed themselves in the yellow pages in Fairbanks, and most of them were Democrats. So the Republican team that wanted to select a U.S. attorney in Fairbanks didn't have a big bench to choose from. The outgoing attorney was Everett Hepp, whose dates are 1915 and 1987, who later became a judge and is a very interesting man in himself. But he was going to be on the way out at that time. Now, it is very interesting, and Terrence Cole did a nice job on discussing this in his book on Bill Snedden, that the local attorneys, most of them, signed a letter opposing the selection of Ted, suggesting that he didn't have the experience and background to become U.S. attorney in Fairbanks. And it won't surprise you that so much of this is clearly about, you know, we're the Alaskans, we're the real Alaskans, why are you picking this guy who's only been here a few months? This is something that's very, very familiar in Alaska's discussions then and now. The judges Ted would have appeared before. First, Harry Pratt, who was the federal judge in Fairbanks from 1935 to 1954. He was born in 1884, raised in Colorado and Kansas, had a law degree from the University of Colorado in Alaska, and was in Alaska 25 years before he was appointed to the bench. He was succeeded in 1954 when Pratt retired. The last 2 years of Ted's tenure as a judge, Vernon B. Forbes, 1954 to 60, is his date as the judge, served as the federal judge in Fairbanks. He was born in 1905, so was approaching 50. He was from North Dakota. To my knowledge, he had never been to Alaska. I suppose this sounds critical, and I guess I am being critical. I'm not guess, I know. Everything about him seems to be essentially small town. He's mostly associated with a small town on the Red River, the boundary between Minnesota and North Dakota. He's been passed over for a seat on the 8th District Court of Appeals, so maybe he was looking for a job. He had a patron in Senator Langer of North Dakota, and when Vernon Forbes came to Alaska in 1954, he was greeted with skepticism in the newspaper. There were a lot of people who criticized, once again, the choice of an outsider. Ted was barely settled in his office when automobile salesman and magnate Cecil Wells was murdered. This was in October of 1953. He was killed in the Northwood Building in Fairbanks. Wells died a few floors above where Ted and his family were living, also in an apartment building in the Northwood Building. This case, the murder of Cecil Wells, drew national and international attention. Life magazine had photographs. The New York Daily News reported the detective magazine. Apparently what had happened was intruders broke into Wells' apartment and killed Cecil Wells, who was about 50, while his fifth wife, a beautiful blonde named Diane, slept nearby. Tabloid magazines were drawn to this essentially because this was the story of wealthy man, fifth wife, and her boyfriend, who was a man named Johnny Warren, who was a jazz musician, and he was black. So all the race aspect of this, the fifth wife, the rich husband, the murder in his bedroom, all of this became fodder for the tabloids, and Ted was right in the middle of this. He was in the middle of this as a district attorney, and he was in the middle of this because the investigation was a mess. The local police lost some of the evidence. They sullied some of the evidence or made it unusable because they dirtied it or in some ways confused it. The police made many mistakes. They were unable to find the murder weapon. They were slow to react in arrests, which the public could understand, the slow to act with arrests. But eventually, they made a hash of the evidence, and a grand jury was convened to investigate the police's conduct, and the police chief was fired at the recommendation of the grand jury. Johnny Warren, the boyfriend, was extradited from California and brought back to Fairbanks. Trial was scheduled for March of 1954. There was no trial. The beautiful Diane Wells committed suicide in Hollywood with a variety of barbiturates. She left a suicide note saying she was very sorry, but she never said who did it or if she did it. She was just said, I'm sorry for all the things that happened. It's quite interesting that Johnny Warren's indictment remained open for 6 years after Diane committed suicide. This wouldn't happen today. The courts wouldn't allow it to happen. But this took up all of Ted's time from essentially October of 1953 to the spring of 1954. Also in the summer of 1954, Ted Stevens was very busy with what I've called the Great White Slavery Trial. This was a Mann Act trial in which a variety of people from Galveston, Texas were all put on trial in Fairbanks, especially Jack Bennett, Wesley Curtin, and three women who were with them. And they were all arrested for transporting a young woman named Marilyn Casey to Alaska for immoral purposes. I tried to talk to Ted about Jackie Bennett, or John Bennett, Jack Bennett as he was known, John Jackie Bennett, and he would just get mad and say, that guy, he lied. Well, I'm not particularly surprised. There's a transcript of this trial at the archives in San Bernardino, California, the Federal Archives, all the cases in territorial days, if they were appealed, there had to be a transcript. So this is very, very interesting. You can get transcripts from cases as far back as 1912. On the other hand, you're going to have to pay for them, and there's some of them, they're a couple hundred bucks, but others are as much as $600. So you have to figure out how much of the fee you can afford. In the transcript, there's a moment I love. Ted Stevens was constantly in this trial banging heads with the lead attorney for the opposition, who was Warren Taylor, well-known attorney in Fairbanks, whose favorite form of objection was, "Just a minute!" And that's in the transcript over and over and over again. Jack Bennett, who Ted was so critical of, was a terrible witness. He was lying so much of the time. This was clear to me as a reader 50 years later, although it was never quite clear to me what he was lying about. Ted and Warren Taylor got into such disputes that finally at one point, Warren challenged Ted to go on the witness stand and become a witness and step down briefly from being the prosecutor. Well, they had a little confab with Vernon Forbes, and Forbes decided it was all right, and the questioning would conform in such a manner that Ted Stevens would not lose his role in the trial if he answered Warren Taylor's questions. You can see the macho bravado on everybody's part in all of this. Well, Warren Taylor wasn't dumb. His question to Ted Stevens began, "Did you know that you were lying when?" And this led to an explosion on Ted Stevens' part, and Judge Forbes decided this was a very bad idea, so we'd go back to the regular form of the trial. Now, in the south side of Fairbanks, Ted Stevens was very busy prosecuting a variety of criminals who were in the nightclub business, which in some cases were just clip joints. One of them was the legendary Princess Zenobia at the Club Birdland, who was a dancer and probably did a lot of other things. In 1955, the police became very agitated at the number of GIs who claimed soldiers that they had been taken advantage of in her club and she'd stolen their money. So they decided, under the leadership of Ed Dankworth, to put together a strike force and go in there. Well, what they did is they sent in a undercover military officer from Ladfield, and he had marked money on him, and he left his wallet on the bar and had a couple of drinks and feigned going to sleep, and the Princess Zenobia stole the money out of his wallet and stuck it in her brassiere on her chest. Well, the Princess Zenobia did not know that the wily Ed Dankworth had put purple dye on the money. So when they came in and did a search to check out what happened to the money, she said she didn't have it, but lo and behold, she had this purple dye on her chest and was arrested, and she got several years sentence. It always interests me. I was told by several people that Ted Stevens had a good relationship, a working relationship, if you could call it that, with the boss of South Fairbanks, who was a bar owner named Raymond Wright. Somebody even told me that they once came into the bar at 5 o'clock in the morning, and Ted Stevens and Ray Wright were washing up the glasses and dishes together. I find this pretty hard to believe, but the person who told me this is an honorable person. In any case, Frank Worth, who was a U.S. Marshal in Fairbanks for many years, and some of you know, later was in the legislature, I asked him if it was plausible that Ted Stevens would have some kind of relationship with Ray Wright, the boss of the South Side. He said, "Of course. If you want to know what the crooks are doing, ask a crook." There were endless numbers of prostitution cases and gambling cases that were prosecuted at this time by Ted and others. One of them in particular was of a woman named Sally Christie, a.k.a. Marion Anderson, Marion Robertson. I got to get that straight. She came from a very privileged background. I don't know if any of you are from St. Louis. She was attended the Mary Institute in St. Louis, which was a very privileged private school. And she was eventually arrested and charged with prostitution. It involved having sexual relationships in the back of a cab, and the police apprehended her and her companion at the time it was happening. The trial of Sally Christie, a.k.a. Marion Robertson in this case, is remarkable for the euphemisms and effort the prosecutors and the defense attorneys made to not describe what actually happened in the back of that cab. There were lots of gambling raids led by Ted against slot machines, pinball machines, wheels of various kinds, And this is where the legend of Two Gun Ted got started, which I think is probably overdone that he wore, I don't know, it gets better all the time. I think now it's white pearl-handled pistols into these clubs. There were places like the Squadron Club with the C-46 attached to a long building that was 76 feet long. The Leacocks, who owned it, advertised friendly mixologists and the fabulous, unbelievable Chesty Lane with their nightly floor shows. My dad called these people the parasites. He was a construction worker and a trapper, and he wouldn't have anything to do with them. This world, I mean, you have to understand, the night people that I've described here existed totally independent of middle class society or people like my parents. Except for this, my dad always took me to the Horseshoe Cigar Store to buy football tickets on the weekend, and you know what? I was 12 years old and I won and they paid off. The newspaper coverage of crime was very frank. It was very direct. Bill Snedden was the publisher of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, wasn't afraid to put it on the front page. And one of my favorite stories involved an airman who was being chased down the street by a young woman who was shooting at him as he was putting on his trousers in what the News Miner, rather primly in this case, called a dispute over personal services. Bill Snedden was very important to Ted Stevens because they had in some ways a uncle-son or father-son relationship, and Bill Snedden of the News Miner was always promoting Ted's interests and his opportunities and saying, we need this young man as a local prosecutor. Although the story that it was Snedden who got Ted Stevens' job in Washington, I'm confident that's not true because the record just doesn't indicate anything like that. Now, to summarize, and I'll be done, Ted's career in Fairbanks, he brought discipline and organization to a chaotic, fluid situation. He both enjoyed the benefits and suffered from being far from Washington. It was nice to know that Washington wasn't around the corner all the time. It gave him a freedom he wouldn't have otherwise had. On the other hand, he probably could have used some of the science that Washington had to have and some of the professionalism. I think he grew up and liked and enjoyed Fairbanks and made some lifetime friends like Jim Messer, who succeeded Cecil Wells in the automobile business. Now, I want to just tell a story and I'll be done. I was visiting Ted Stevens, or maybe we're having coffee or something. Visiting, I mean, it would be, we would go out to lunch and be besieged by people who wanted to talk to him, and I'd try to get a word in. And he was telling me that if he was about to pick a federal judge, and this federal judge was going to be Ralph Bisline. Eventually it was. And he said, you know, I'm getting all this mail from people in Anchorage. I get all these letters. They keep saying, don't pick anybody from Fairbanks. Come on, what are you doing? Don't pick anybody from Fairbanks. Pick somebody from Anchorage. There's nothing up in Fairbanks. So Ted said to me, you know, these people are forgetting. I lived in Fairbanks. I have friends in Fairbanks. I liked Fairbanks. And then he smiled.
How are we doing time-wise?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Michael's a tough act to follow.
We'll see what we can do. We put a teaser in the advertisement for this program in which I said, in essence, in 1965, Ted needed help in his law office. I signed on. I had no idea what I was getting into. And I think probably I'll be able to demonstrate that to you in a few minutes. In 1965, I was an assistant United States attorney. Ted had moved to Anchorage. He was newly partnered with John Savage. They relocated after the earthquake into a building on 8th Avenue that was brand new. Ted was going to the legislature. His longtime secretary, right-hand person, Barb Crist, later Barb Andrews, most recently Barbara G. Said, you know, Ted, you need help. And he probably said whatever or something like that. Anyway, Barbara got together with the lead secretary in the U.S. Attorney's Office, a gal named Thelma Dome, who was a real crackerjack. The two of them decided that Ted should hire me. an interview was set up.
It was very perfunctory. It was obvious that the fix was in. I went to work for Ted.
John Savage had his
personal injury practice.
Ted
had his business, real estate, some oil
and gas practice that I was supposed to help him with. And the idea was that the steady fees from our work would balance out the boom and bust of the PI practice. Well, that worked pretty well. Early on, however, John decided that he also brought it into the office.
And shortly
thereafter,
Biller went also.
And now we some of the stuff that I didn't realize what I was getting into. Those guys had a very different idea about how fees should work. They wanted to use a point system. You got points for bringing the case in. You got points for doing this. You got points for doing that.
The long and short of it is
the guys that did the hourly work were going to take it.
We struggled with that for some months.
Eddie Reeser decided that he wasn't too enthusiastic about law. He decided to write the great American political novel. Went to Tahiti to do it.
Shortly thereafter,
Edwards got brought on as part of the firm. It went through so many name changes that nobody could keep up with it, I suspect.
At any rate,
things were going on okay.
We're still arguing over this pricing thing, the point system.
But,
you might have worked that out,
I guess. But something else happened that I
also didn't realize I was going to be getting into.
And that was that,
John started talking about having Tom Crowe join the forum.
Well, I knew Tom from Fairbanks, where he'd been an assistant U.S. attorney.
John also started talking about the idea of, he and his Michael were talking to one another.
Maybe he should come in also.
At that point,
Ted and I had a problem.
Basically, Ted said, I'm out of here. Came to me one day and said, look, I'm going to leave. You can either stay or come with me. What do you want to do? From my standpoint, that was a no-brainer.
I went with Ted.
He set up our own office at 6 to 8, and we're fat, dumb, and happy for
a few months.
Things didn't go so well over the years for the rest of that crew that we left behind. John Savage died at a much too early age. Same thing with Tom Cohen.
Eddie
sort of disappeared into the woodwork.
And I understand that his book maybe was published
in French, but if it was ever published in English, I
never heard of it.
And Kent Edwards went on to be a United States attorney, had his face set to become
a United States District Court judge, and got cut up pretty bad in the process of the pushing and hauling over who was going to take that position, that ultimately
Jim Fitzgerald
wound up getting appointed to. At any rate, things didn't go so well for those guys, but Ted and I were doing just fine and were very happy.
Ted
went to
Mexico with
him in was it late 67 or late 68? It must have been 67. Vacation.
At that point, Senator Bob Bartlett passed away. The word got passed around very quickly. There were two
prime
candidates for that
vacancy because the governor was going to appoint someone to fill the unexpired term of Senator Bartlett. Ted rushed back from Mexico.
The governor called Ted and the other candidate, who just happened to be a friend of Ted, a
political associate
of his, and
in addition, a client of our law firm by the name of Carl Brady. Governor called Carl and Ted to Juneau and said, gee, I don't know what to do.
Who should I appoint?
Now, what I'm going to tell you is not the story that everybody knows, I don't think. You may find out. But I asked Ted years later, and I asked Carl years later, independently, what went on? They both told me exactly the same thing. They said, the governor said, I don't know who to appoint. Carl said, governor, appoint Ted. And that's what happened. I think it was one of the most generous and wise political acts that I've ever heard of. Carl was a wonderful businessman. May have been a decent politician. There's no question but all of us in the long run were far better off having Ted Stevens as the United States Senator for Alaska. The appointment went very quickly. Ted came back to Anchorage and said, I'm out of here. What are we going to do with the law firm? Again, I had no idea what I was getting into when I signed on. Suddenly, I was going to be all by myself. That wasn't going to work. There were some clients that I had no relationship with whatever. It wasn't going to look good for a young whippersnapper like me back then to be practicing alone and trying to take care of a few of them pretty heavy-duty clients. So there had to be help. The help is with us today, and we'll be talking to us shortly. Jack came on board. I don't know how long he was with the firm. He'll tell you probably. It wasn't very long, but soon enough he went his way. I went my way doing my thing. And, you know, the rest that goes on beyond that you sort of know about probably. But let me wrap it up by saying this. There's, I think, always naturally been sort of a assumption in the legal community, if not elsewhere, that Ted and I were close personal friends. Well, we were close friends, but it was totally at a business professional level. He had his friends, I had my friends. He had his family that he was very close to. He and Fitzgerald and their families were all very close. I had a different group. We didn't socialize together. We had a wonderful relationship. Michael and the other media folk talk about terrible Ted's temper. You know, in the short 3 years that I'm talking to you about, and it is only about 3 years that I'm talking about, I never saw that. Ted was totally calm, cool, and collected. We had a wonderful relationship, and I was sort of devastated to see him go away. I thought I was getting into something that was going to be a small practice for the rest of my working career. Thank you very much. Or did you?
Hi. My role, you've got me on tape? My role today is to talk about Ted the person. Perhaps before talking about Ted, let me tell you a little about myself. I came up in 54, had 1 year of law school at the University of Washington, started some small businesses. Richfield discovered oil in July of 57 down in Kenai. I got a business partner, went back to law school, commuted. There's no way to learn law, I'll tell you. But graduated in 1959, took the Alaska Bar several times, and was prepared to practice law in early 61. Enough of me right now. Let's get to Ted. Ted's parents were divorced when he was six. He said he didn't blame his father, who he saw only once after the divorce, but I think his early childhood, just like the rest of us, greatly shaped the man he became. After the divorce, he was raised by his grandfather, that Michael has mentioned, an accountant working for the Nehi Brewing Company in Indianapolis. Ted told me this man was 6'2", a Mason, a joiner, a staunch Republican, and he was my role model, said Ted. After his grandfather died, Ted went to live with his father, sister, and her husband, Walter, in Manhattan Beach, California. Ted wrote that Walter had been a motorcycle carrier during World War I, and after the Depression had left Detroit penniless. Ted called him a survivor. A tool and die maker working for a Howard Hughes company in California, Ted said his Uncle Walter had loaned him the $5,000 he needed to go to the Harvard Law School. And later, Ann, his wife, and Ted bought him a new Ford station wagon, which he drove until he died. If I ever write a book, Ted once wrote me, he, Walter, will be prominent because he probably influenced me more than anyone else. So count them. Two mentors to replace his father, plus probably Bill Snedden up in Fairbanks. But back to 61, I was ready to practice law. I got a call from the Anchorage Times editor, Bob Kedrick, who I'd palled around with as a bachelor, come to my office. And so I did in the Anchorage Times building, and I met a guy I'd never seen before. I don't think I had ever heard of him. I was too busy in law school, I guess. Kedrick said, why don't you two guys are going to start practicing law. Why don't you practice together? And Ted and I must have looked at each other and said, why not, you know? Well, two more different people you couldn't find. Ted was very smart, very hardworking, and honest. I tried to be honest. So with a SBA loan, Stevens and Roderick opened their office on the rear of the top floor of the City National Bank building at 5th and E, which is now still a gift shop, I think. Ely, Guess, and Rudd were opening their office in the front of that same floor. Ted and I walked down the hall at one point, and Joe Rudd showed us how they were setting up their office. I recall they had colored-coded folders. Ted and I walked back and said, no, that's not for us. We're not going to do that. A couple things I remember, though, in that office. One time, standing in my office, Ted looked out at the Susitna, and he said, God damn it, those guys in Washington, D.C. think they own that land. People ought to be able to go out there and settle any way they want. I probably said something, fine, Ted, but, you know, who's going to build the schools and the roads? He said, oh, forget that. That'll just happen. The other, he represented Atlantic Refining, and which was before it became ARCO in the late 60s, and also, I think, Mobil. I represented Pure Oil. He got a call from somebody at Atlantic saying something to do with a lease or leasing. So Ted went over to the law library in the old courthouse, spent about an hour, came back, dictated to Barb, our secretary. She had the memo out the same day. I remember standing there thinking, my God, That would have taken me 2 days. Needless to say, he was a good lawyer. One of my clients when I was practicing was Mike Gravel. In 62, Ted ran against the old man, as he called him, Ernest Greening, and lost, of course. I was then the South Central campaign manager for the Democratic Party. And needless to say, we didn't talk much politics. And I didn't have much to do with Ernest Greening's campaign, anything actually. In 62, suddenly my business partner, Charlie Barnes, who was a Shell, had been a Shell landman, suddenly died. And actually, Bob Kedrick of the Times died that same year. So I had to decide, what am I going to do? I had about three companies, and I decided I'd have to run the companies. Well, after the 64 earthquake, Ted was elected to the House, as you probably know. So when Wally Hickel beat Bill Egan in 66, Ted was there in Juneau to carry Wally's water, legislative water. I think somebody should research the fact that I think Ted basically single-handedly rebuilt the Republican Party in the state of Alaska. He really did. He worked at it all the time. But speaking of the earthquake, my wife, Martha, with our two kids and a couple of kids staying with us and her own kids, ended up spending that night at the Stevens with Ann with her five kids. Ted was in Fairbanks, and I was down at Alaska getting off the mountain. My oldest daughter tells me this, that all those nine kids were there, and somebody came to the door and said, there's a tsunami coming. Go to higher ground. And these two women, Anne and Martha, looked at each other and simultaneously began to laugh. Nine sleeping kids? You're going to go to higher ground? And also, Martha, a couple years ago, asked all those kids to write about that evening. And they all remembered the same thing, which was somebody yelled fire. And the fire was that George, the Stevens black lab, had put his tail in the fireplace and was waving it around the room. Another story with Martha and Ann and Ted. They were giving Martha and Ann were giving a fundraiser, some sort of fundraiser having to do with gambling, as I recall, and the stove blew up. So they were there, you know, it had gotten on the ceiling and on the walls, and so the two women got out and started to clean in the walls, and Ted came in and said, what the hell are you doing? The claims adjuster hasn't been here yet. Now, there's a good lawyer. I could talk about Ann for 20 minutes. She was just a terrific woman. Of course, she was killed in 78, along with Joe Rudd, as a matter of fact, out here at now the Ted Stevens International Airport. And Ann was a orphan, had been adopted by Ben Charrington, the Denver University Chancellor, and his wife, Edith. And Ann was a Democrat. That's another story, but she obviously didn't advertise it too much. Ted met her when she was working for the State Department in Washington, D.C. Well, back to the 60s, I took my family to India as a director there, and when we got back in the fall of 68, Ted had been defeated by Omar Rasmussen in the Republican Party primary, and he was emotionally crushed. I could tell you how I know that, but he was. He just, his life, his political life had come to an end. A couple weeks later, he said, well, why don't we go buy a computer store, computer business? I said, well, okay. So we walked down 6th Avenue to about Fairbanks Street, and there was a kind of a stone building, and we walked in there, and you young people won't remember this, but computers were from floor to ceiling, and there was kind of a moisturized building. And we walked out on the sidewalk, and I said, Ted, if we buy this building, who's going to run it? And he said, oh, that's not important. So I thought, there's another lawyer who doesn't know a damn thing about running businesses. A couple weeks later, as you know, Bob Bartlett died, and Wally Hickel appointed him to the U.S. Senate. So in a matter of weeks, he went from the bottom to the top. He had the job he'd always wanted. Well, Ted had three major clients, and Russ was his partner at the time, practicing. One was Bill Snedden at the Fairbanks News Miner up in Fairbanks. One was Augie Hebert, Channel 11, KTVA. And one was Larry and Kay Fanning at the Anchorage Daily News. I went to Fairbanks. It took Bill Snedden about a half an hour to decide he didn't want this young neophyte, unseasoned lawyer, as particularly a liberal Democrat. Augie's business, I think Russ took over, and I took over the Daily News, and I remained Kay Fanning's lawyer for most of the 18 years she spent here. Couple more anecdotes, I think. Well, Ted's first job in Washington, D.C., of course, was to get Wally Hickel confirmed as Nixon's Secretary of Interior, which he did, followed by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act a year later, and then 2 years later, the Alaska Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act. And as you know, in all those cases, he was very effective, and he was a fighter and a gambler, and a what I tell later about a warrior. I'll take 1 minute to talk about his supposed temper. When the Stevens family first went to Washington, after Wally had appointed Ted to the Senate in late 68, Ann bought Ted two books on how to control his temper. And I have no reason to doubt that he read them both. My good friend, lawyer Don Mitchell, who is not here today, and I'm going to give him hell for that, remember Ted as a bully because of some of the way he treated staff in Washington, D.C. I never saw Ted bullying anybody. He may have when he got excited. He had quite an important job. The only time I saw him is when Bill Bettner and I would be playing tennis and he would miss a shot. He wasn't a natural athlete, but he had quick hands. And he'd get mad as hell, but only at himself. Not to summarize here, but, you know, with his background, I'm not surprised. Quickly, when I was mayor of the borough in 73, working on the commuter rail from the valley down here. That's 40 years ago, still working on it.
It will be for a while.
I asked Ted to get me an appointment with the Secretary of Transportation, which he did. I went back there. I recall the guy was a former Union Oil executive. He looked at my figures. He said, well, you're just too small. We can't help you at all. So I told Ted that. Ted said, well, I tried to get you $20 million. And I said, Ted, I never asked you for any money. No, but I knew you were going to need it. So that became our private joke. Every once in a while, I'd see him. I'd say, well, I never asked you for any money. No, but I knew you had that here. Couple little ones here. I had my hip replaced in 2004, and Ted came to see me at the Providence. I was drugged from surgery, but at that time, it was the Iraqi war was on everybody's mind, and I thought those neocons were not only misdirected, but probably dangerous. So I'm laying in bed, and I'm looking at Ted, and I'm saying, Ted, you're a warrior. He looked at me. I said, yeah, you're a warrior. And he said, Jack, I don't believe in counseling. I didn't laugh at the time, but I laugh now, because that is so Stevens. Don't try to change what I got. I've worked too hard at it. I believe what I believe, and don't mess with me. Several years ago, he wrote me, you have very few real friends back here. Thank God one of them is Dan Inouye, a true friend. We call each other brother. I bugged him a lot about, not a lot, but a little. Come on, write your own book. And 2 years ago, he wrote me, after this dust settles, I will begin a book. Not right away, but soon. And my last little anecdote I like, David Cuddy decided he'd run against Ted, and our kids grew up with the Cuddy kids and around the Cuddy kids. So Martha, a Democrat, went and re-registered as a Republican, voted for Ted, went back and re-registered as a Democrat. And when Ted heard it, he wrote her a note. This was my Christmas miracle. So, a very smart, hardworking, honest man who liked what he did, and he liked it very much. Should we call him the Alaskan of the century? I think we should. Thank you.
Thank you very much to our panelists. That was really interesting and informative, and just the kind of program we were hoping to hear today. I wanted to also welcome and say thank you to our guests from the AVAIL program and the Anchorage Youth Court. We're really glad to have you here. We hope you enjoyed it. And you've all got, I think, a loaf of bread, courtesy of Barbahood and the Great Harvest Bakery, and we're thinking maybe that should go to the newest member of the bar at your table, or if you choose to figure it out a different way, you can wrestle for it or something. So thank you very much for joining us today. Have I left out anything? Okay, good. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next year.
Thank you.